Session number 9722.
Mr. Levine, room 4.
On our left flank was the Americans, the battalion of Americans, who had come up a few days previously. And by this time, the front was quiet. For some reason or other, the commander of the Americans, whether they had been instructed to or not, decided to climb out of their trenches and charge at the enemy lines, which was about 100 metres away. And it was sheer murder for them. I believe a man named Merriman was the commander, and they started calling him Murderer Merriman afterwards, I believe. But it was just absurd because they were just charging into machine gun fire.
Did you actually see it?
No, I didn't. I didn't. But I couldn't connect this firing, which we were told to do, the British. They didn't ask the British to go over the top. The Americans were asked, you see. Whether it was an idea to blood them or not, I don't know. But it was, from what I know now, it was simply ridiculous because it was just charging across 100 metres of open ground against machine gun fire, which was just impossible. And they suffered very greatly. But we did not know, nor we were told what took place. But during the remainder of that time, the British were on the Jarama, along with other IB units and Spanish Republican soldiers, for 4 months, from February the 12th to the middle of June, when we finally left the Jarama. And the Jarama, I've been back to the Jarama, and the trenches are still there, and that part around Madrid was never taken.
Can you describe your own wounding at Jarama?
Well, that was a very unusual thing. On the Jarama, things were now quiet, and Copeman, who knew me as the... I had no contact with him, but he knew I was a political commissar, whatever that might mean, of the number one company, and that this was now my third front. So, and by that time, the morale was low amongst the British, because they'd lost a lot of people. 156 lost their lives on the Jarama, besides wounded. And from the original 500 or 600 that went, there was very few left. There was people who'd come on later on, but there were very few left of the original force that went to Jarama. And he sent for me and asked me, would I take someone else, a comrade of mine, and he would provide 2 Spanish soldiers, and would I go on a night raid to the enemy lines? Because he had been asked by headquarters to get a prisoner, because they wanted to know what was going on. See, it was quiet, except for desultory firing in the morning and at night. That took place every day to let you know everybody was there. We fired, they fired back, and that would be repeated at dusk. Right, I said, I'll go. I must have been balmy. And we were not really equipped to jump into a trench and grab a prisoner because we were toting a rifle. Now, you see, there was always firing during the night, a bit of desultory firing. And you can't go along crabwise with a rifle. It's a bit. We got near to the fascist lines, and they used to use explosive bullets, and they would hit the olive trees and it would give a bit of an explosion of fire. And as we got to the lines, the fascist lines, they were having a sing-song. And I thought, this is hopeless about jumping over into these lines. Now, we had a password, because all along our front, the soldiers on guard duty there were given this password, because also at that period the fascists would send over patrols towards our lines and to try and find out what was going on. And we left our lines at a gap in the barbed wire and made for the same barbed wire to get back. Now, we got within about 5 metres of the trench, and I was waiting for the password to be called out and for us to give the reply to that password. But this was a line where there was young Spanish soldiers, And they must have got panicky because they must have seen us crawling through. We were crawling, we weren't not standing up because we didn't want to suddenly stand up because it would made startle the other people, the people in our lines. And there was two soldiers on guard duty there. One threw a grenade and one fired his rifle. Now the grenade bounced in front of us, and my pal, he got a splinter in his back of his hand. And I thought I was okay, but the two Spanish soldiers with us called out to their Spanish comrades, you know, like, what the hell they were doing, firing at their own people. And they were terribly upset, these two soldiers, of what they'd done. And as I report back to Copeman, I notice blood pouring down my arm, my sleeve, whatever. And I was shot in the arm, my right arm, and I was very lucky to be alive because my right arm was cradling round my head as you were crawling, you know, like that. So it must have missed my skull by an inch the most. And it was only a flesh wound. And I went to the first aid post along with my comrade, who was a Scot named Dave Mowat. And we were treated by two American medics, two medical students. They were not doctors, they were students. And I mention this because on Villanueva de la Cañada, on my next action outside Madrid, the same advanced dressing station was manned by these two American New York medical students. And when they saw me, I was one of the first casualties of that, you know, when they came out of the village, the enemy, and fighting. They said, well, I wouldn't tell you exactly what the swear word they used, but they said, it's got that goddamn, you know, Levine here again, you know, I made a joke of it. And I lay down there, they gave me some morphine. The village of Quijona was burning. The wheat stubble was burning in the fields around me. There was this great big action taking place. All the international brigades were there. So was Lister's brigade, Campesino, all these crack regiments of the Spanish Republican Army by this time were now organized and trained. And I lay there, and I was violently sick later on during the night because we'd been drinking rancid water. We couldn't get any water. It was a heat wave at the time. And we dug into a dried river, smelt of sulfurous, like rotten eggs or something like that, and I don't know whatever else the morphine had had or this water, but I was violently sick during the night, and that was my last time in action.
Do you know approximately when you were wounded?
Yes, it was as dusk fell. The enemy came out of the village, Villanueva de la Cañada, and the story is, now I didn't remain with the heap of soldiers that was lying around Copeman in the ditch. You know, the first reaction against people, soldiers in warfare, was to get close to each other. It's only the trained, disciplined soldier that realizes that he shouldn't be close to anybody else because he offers a bigger target and all that. And there were heaped around him in the ditch on the side of the road. And I moved over from the side of the road into this stubble field, along with Sid Quinn and two other blokes, and lay in the furrows in the field. Now, again, we were being fired on from sniper fire from the church tower, and this was in the afternoon. Now, the reaction of people is that they can't lie down for hours like that without having to look up and see what's going on, but it was fatal to look up. And first, a bloke from London, Harry Gross, from the East End, he looked up to see what was going on, and he got up a bit more than he should have done, and he got the bullet in his stomach. It didn't take very long for him to die. There was four of us there. That was three left. Then Paddy Davis, a very fine Irishman, who'd been in the Brigade of Guards, a big six-footer he was, great man, and he got up to have a look at what was going on, and he got the bullet through his temple, and he died. So there was two of us left there. And then shortly after that, dusk had now fallen, and the enemy had come out of the village, because they had to get out. They were surrounded from all sides, and they had to go in the direction of Brunetti, which we hadn't yet taken, you see. That's where the fascist soldiers were also stationed there. And the story is that they were pushing the women and children from the village in front of them as a screen. Well, I didn't see that. I don't know. I only saw there was four soldiers in the field, just about half a dozen metres away from the road, walking towards me in the dusk. And I stood up along with Quinn, and I fired. And I saw three, and I fired again. And I saw two, and then I got hit. And with it going into my bicep, the rifle was flung out of my hand. And then something fell from my fist, from my hand, from my fingers. And I thought, in all that immediate second, you know, I thought it was a bone, you know. My arm was shattered and a bone was falling out. But it was a cartridge which I was ready to load into my rifle. And somebody took me away. You know, in warfare, in action, there was always someone ready to take a wounded person away, because it meant they were getting out of it, at least for a short period of time. And some bloke got hold of me and took me to the dressing station. And that was that. That was the end of my fighting career.
Do you know the dates that you were wounded on both occasions?
Oh, yes.
Can you say
that? Oh, no. I don't know the date of Harama. I don't know the date because, I mean, the date was not implanted on my memory, because it was just like any other day, apart from the incident that took place. But the other one, I know the date, because that was the first day of the Brunetti Offensive. It was the 6th of July, 1937.
But which month would you have been wounded in as Harama?
I can only estimate it was in April. And I went to a hospital in Cuenca province.
Can you tell me what you were telling me earlier, off the record, about what you know about the killing of John Cornford?
Now, down on the front at La Pera, I remember regrouping after some action, and now we're in the olive growing. It's all olive in that particular area. I mean, that's a big olive growing area. And I had been in some other sector of the front, but most of the other people there had been on another sector, which was in front of us, and they'd come off this hill and were now regrouping after losing many people there. And somebody called out, I remember this very clearly, they said Ralph Fox had been left on the hill wounded, and this young man John Cornford, who had a bandage round his head because he'd been wounded at University City in the November and December fighting and joined us to go to La Pera, he immediately haired off to help this man. Now, he never returned. And with the confusion and all that, there's very little had been written later on about Cornford. There was always this mystery how Cornford, and I actually saw what took place, what had happened. And eventually, many, many years later, I wrote to Cornford's brother, who was a professor at the Royal School of Art in London, because I'd read a book called Journey to the Frontier by two American academics who had researched the life of Julian Bell and John Cornford. And in that book, there was a mystery how John had lost his life. And I, later on, got in touch with Cornford's brother and wrote to him and told him what I knew. And he was very moved, he says. I was very touched by how my brother lost his life, you know, and he thanked me very much, etc., for writing to him. And so on. I have the letter here.
Did you know Cornford at all?
Only knew him because when he came from the Madrid front to join this first British company as part of the Franco-Belge battalion, the Marseille battalion, he came to the billet in which I was staying, about half a dozen of us. And there was about five survivors of the British small group there, about 20, were fighting on the Madrid front in November and December. And they were allocated to different billets, and Cornford came into the billet in which I was staying in. And that's how I knew him, and knew who he was, John. But who John Cornford was, or what his background, etc., was, Of course, I did not know.
What kind of impression did he make on you, if any?
Well, he obviously was a middle-class bloke, public school type, if you like, well-spoken, about 6 foot tall, looked very pale and ill, and had this white bandage around his head. And he didn't converse very much with us. He seemed to be very withdrawn. And I can remember one incident when he was asked to go to supper at Tom Winterton's headquarters in the village of Madrigueras, because evidently Winterton knew about this man, who he was and his background. But I was there when the runner came, and Colvin made some excuse that no, he wasn't able to go. And I had the feeling that this man felt he didn't want to be singled out for preferential treatment against the comrades he was in that billet.
What about Ralph Fox? Did you come across him?
I only came Ralph Fox when he joined us when we got to Albacete. Now, he was tremendously excited that he was going to the front. He was going to be the commissar of that company, you see. And I remember him because he had a horse blanket he'd got from somewhere. There was a monogram on this blanket at the corner, and he was terribly enthusiastic. And I knew of Ralph Fox, who he was, because he'd been a writer, and he used to write for the Daily Worker, an Oxbridge graduate, and that sort of thing. And strangely enough, but a couple of years ago, his great niece got in touch with me. She was a young woman who was at the Cheltenham Ladies' College, and for her dissertation on something or other, and she'd mentioned to one of her teachers that her uncle or great uncle, I forget, because he came from some middle class background, you'd think his father was a clergyman, was Ralph Fox in Halifax. And her teacher said to her, "Why don't you write? You're always telling me about the Civil War, about Ralph Fox." So she got in touch with me, along with other people, no doubt. And what did I remember of this man? Well, I told her as far as I could, and that's all I was able to do.
And what about St. John Sprague, Christopher Curdwell?
Yeah, well, before I leave Ralph Fox, in the 1950s, I went to Halifax, where they were putting up, through the efforts of E.P. Thompson, who I think was at Cambridge or Oxford with him, it was Oxford, along with a man who used to write a scientific column for the Guardian, Monster Guardian in those names, named Crosenau. A populariser of science he was. And they were both at Magdalen College with him at the time. And they held a function there in which a seat was donated by the city council to be placed in the town square in Halifax. And I was in touch with E.P. Thompson about 3 or 4 years ago, and he told me that he'd been back to Halifax. The form had been replaced, you know, in memory of Ralph Fox, had been replaced there just you know, in the last 2 or 3 years or 4 years ago.
The question I was going to ask you was about Christopher Curdwell, if you got
no,
to him.
No, but Christopher, I told you about this man, Clem Beckett, who was real tough working class type, great dirt track rider, the originator of the Wall of Death in this country, toured the continent and Russia with this fairground attraction. And he, for some reason or other, had teamed up with this writer. Now, Clem Beckett, when he got to Spain, was put in the Park Auto. That is where they serviced the lorries and all that sort of thing, because he was an expert mechanic. But he came to Spain to fight, and he didn't want it, you see, and he left it, and teamed up with this Christopher Curdwell, St. John Sprague, whatever his real name was, and they both lost their lives on a machine gun. He was a machine gunner from the Territorial Army, was this man, Clem Beckett, covering the retreat from that front on the first day of fighting, February the 12th, under Harama. And they teamed up with, I've got a photograph of, I just can't get hold of it. These photographs was taken from a newspaper, was printed about 30 years ago by an IB chap who wrote for the Corp, the court press had a Sunday newspaper called the Sunday Referee, I think it was called. And he did sit, this chap, Walter Greenhalgh, he lives in London, although he's a Manchester man, was originally, and he did a series of about four articles on his experiences in the Civil War. He knows a lot about Nathan. He was closer to Nathan than I was because he became a runner for him later on.
And Julian Bell, did you get to know him?
No. I only know that he lost his life on the Brunetti front, and he was driving an ambulance. And by the way, there were many doctors who came out to tend the wounded, you know, and that sort of thing, who weren't content with that. They went to the front and got killed. I knew two. There was Sullenberger, an American. I don't know, I think he was in London as a postgraduate doing work or something. He got killed on the Brunetti front. There was a Dr. Bradshaw from Birmingham Way who got wounded on the front there. And it wasn't unusual, you know, for these people to say, well, I'm not going to be at the rear. I've come here to fight, you know, fascism, and I know what it means and so on. It's amazing. I was in Madrid at the 50th anniversary of the International Brigades, and there was a lot of Americans there. And despite the fact that lots of them, especially in the Americans, some were professors, a lot of them had done well financially, you know, some were now living in retirement in Florida and Miami and so on. And lots of them had been in the Second World War. And lots of our people had been in the Second World War, like myself too. That nevertheless, the Spanish Civil War had a tie with us and a meaning, which I can only put it down to the hardships and the fact that we were always outgunned, you know, the enemy had greater resources than us and so on, and we were always hungry, you know, badly clothed and so on, and that experience is something which has never left any of us.
Now, we've talked quite a bit about Fred Copeman, but off the record, can we say something on tape now about what personal contact you had with him and what kind of a chap he was?
I think Copeman was a very good chap, a good soldier, but I think also he was inclined to be too emotional. For example, I remember on the night of July the 5th, marching from round about the Escorial to go to the front. It's all in that direction. That's where a lot of fighting took place in that area. Maya de Honda and all round there, and Bordula del Monte, all that area. And we were marching. During the day, we sheltered so the enemy aviation couldn't see us, that there was going to be a great big offensive now, first government offensive. And there was trucks coming back who'd taken troops forward, you see, and we were marching, the British. And they only had little apertures for the light, but that wasn't good enough for Copeman. You know, he was already strung up, you see, and he would bash at these lights. I was next to him with his revolver, but, you know, put that bloody light out, you know, and that sort of thing. I have nothing against Copeman. He did what he was able to do, and unfortunately he might have gone off the line politically when he returned to this country. He was fated in many ways. He became the chief of the air raid precautions in London, and went to many a Guildhall banquet, and but finally I was instrumental in him coming to the seminar at Loughborough, which took place in 1976, in August 1976, and he sat next to me, and he said, "I'm glad to be back, Maurice," he says, you know, I realise that what I did, I shouldn't have done, you know, like, he converted to Catholicism, did you know that?
Yes.
And he says, "I got carried away by being fated and going to Guildhall banquets and all that sort of thing." But he was persona non grata. And
with left-wing people?
And even Alexander, I must tell you this, although it's on tape, maybe I shouldn't say it, but you can edit it if you wish. And Alexander came for part of the week, the other part of the week, to Loughborough. In fact, I was his chairman at his dissertation on some aspect in International Brigade. And he saw I was talking to Coleman, although I'd never been friendly with Coleman before, but somehow or other he seemed to know who I was, I don't know. And Alexander says to me, you know what he says about King Street? Because he says, those bloody, he said, Coleman, you say, those bloody bastards at King Street, and that was the headquarters of the CP. Oh, I says, I think he's got over that phase. I said, he's just told me that he's glad to be back. I said, unless accept it in that way.
I think you said that on one occasion he was actually weeping, was he?
I saw him weeping after the Brunetti offensive. Don't forget, Harama and the Brunetti offensive, I estimate it was 86 lost at Brunetti, 153. That's about 230-odd Britishers lost their lives in these two actions, apart from a hell of a lot of wounded. The battalion was never the same after that. Spaniards came into it, you know, and all that sort of thing. You know, it was never the same, no question about that. And I saw him, he came to the hospital I was at, in which Tudor Hart was the surgeon. And he was walking along the corridor, and he wore a great big sheepskin coat, which was an issue from the Russians, I think, which commanders were getting. And he must, this was after Brunetti, and I actually saw Coleman weeping. Now, I'm not surprised at that, because he's a highly emotional man. He was a tough guy, a former heavyweight champion boxer of the Navy when he was in the Royal Navy, one of the leaders of the Emma Gordon Mutiny, and that took place in the north of Scotland somewhere. And he was a really tough guy, leader of the London Unemployed, one of the leaders of the London Unemployed in the hunger marches and the demonstrations of the 1930s. And I don't know, I'm nothing against Coleman. He was a good soldier and did what he had to do. What he turned out in immediate post-war years, the Communist Party sent him to Russia after the war to try and, you know, build up his morale, as you might say, but that's another story, that's something else.
Now, can I ask you about this work that you did as a political commissar? You said it was mainly welfare work. Can you say more specifically what that meant?
Well, for example, I remember on the Harama, there was one man there who had been at the Harama from the early days. He was a Welshman. I'm not going to tell you his name because he died recently. And he was walking about all day, you know, during the quiet time, because away from the trench, the ground fell away a bit, so he was free of any fire. It used to go over the top. And he was kept putting pieces of bits of newspaper on his nose and blowing it off. I thought, he's a bit queer, and I spoke to him. And he was a bit shell-shocked, you know, and that sort of thing. Now, I told George Aitken, who was the brigade commissar, not battalion. The battalion commissar was a man named Williams from the Midlands. I spoke to Aitken, and I said, look, this man's no use, you know. I says, I think he should be taken to the rear. And Aitken, who had been in the First World War, knew all about people going off the rocker and that sort of thing, couldn't stand it and so on,